Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Ashman Family JCC empowers you to experience Jewish paths toward a life of joy, purpose, and meaning through innovative Jewish learning and wellness programs, community building, and initiatives to develop the next generation of Jewish leaders. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 270. We are Torah. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rothberg.
And we are here for our wrap-up, think-back, look-back conversation about this unit of episodes, pretty big unit that we've just completed about the Bible. And before we jump into our conversation, I just wanted to, as we always do in these episodes, just ask for and be thankful for your support of Judaism Unbound. It's a call out to all the folks who are listening to this podcast and who listen regularly to hopefully consider supporting our work. The way that you can do that is that we really encourage a mindset of about a dollar per episode, something in the realm of $50 a year. And we have just announced a new perk. Lex, you want to tell folks about it?
I would love to tell folks about it. You, yes, you listener, can have your voice on this podcast, your literal voice, not just like metaphorical, like, we want your voices to contribute through emails and feedback. Like, your literal voice can now be on the podcast. We are saying that for our voices that will be welcomed on the podcast, we are asking folks to be patrons of ours. So that means that you just support us in that way that Dan just described on Patreon or on Kindful, basically any of the ways you can donate to us at judaismunbound.com/donate. But we will be having, as part of our episodes in the future, guest questions from all of you who are listeners. And those questions can be big picture questions that have been sitting with you for a long time, or they can be, you know, fun questions about Dan and I, whatever really you'd like. And you can submit those. We have a form that you can submit those if you're one of our patrons. And just be in touch with us if you have ideas for those questions. We, of course, will ask you to send an audio file. We can help you do that. But we're really excited to have some voices from our listeners, from our supporters that will be part of the podcast moving forward.
And so that perk is available for folks who are supporting us roughly at this level of a dollar per episode. So you can do that by signing up for a $5 a month monthly contribution. And you can do that, as Lex was saying, on either Patreon or through our website. So if you sign up for a monthly recurring donation, which is the best kind of donation because it allows us to know what to expect and that allows us to do planning. So if you do that at the $5 a month or more level, then you will get that perk. We're working on other perks too. And if you want to just make, you'd rather just make a one-time donation of $60 or more, that's the equivalent on an annual basis. So we are very grateful for all your support and look forward to introducing this and other new perks. I'm trying to think if there is any direct connection to the Bible on this, but I guess I would say that a lot of the Bible does involve all kinds of stories where people are either contributing, you know, half shekels, or they're contributing their earrings and gold, sometimes for things like building of the tabernacle, sometimes for building things like the golden calf. And we appreciate all donations for all kinds of Jewish art projects, whether they're tabernacles or golden calves.
Also, people contributing their kvetching and their creative questions comes up all over the Bible.
Yeah, so we're combining the kvetching and the donation in a really quite new way. And I think that really that's actually the beginning of what I kind of wanted to start to say about the Bible, because I was thinking about it that we've gotten a lot of really positive, enthusiastic feedback on the series about the Bible on certain episodes and just on the whole series. And I'm sitting with it and thinking, like, why does it really matter, the Bible? You know, what is the, like, I think there's a kind of a simple notion that people have that of course it matters. I mean, the Bible is the foundation of Judaism. It was, you know, given at Mount Sinai, it was really the main book of Judaism. And it's actually, I'm not even sure that that's true, right? I think that it's not even clear to me, even though there are those who call the Jews the people of the book. My understanding of that phrase actually is that it comes from Islam, that the Muslims called the Jews the people of the book. And maybe that was descriptively correct for a certain set of Jews. But it's not really even clear to me that the Jews have been so quite so bookish, actually. You know, I think that the vast majority of Jewish history was kind of an oral tradition. The Bible was really composed in writing quite late in the game. There were already, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years of proto-Jewish life before the Bible became a book. And then pretty soon after the Bible became a book, there was all kinds of exiles and stuff. And you know, relatively soon thereafter, the Talmud started to be written. And the Talmud isn't really exactly a book. It's kind of a long, and the Talmud is mostly, it's called the oral tradition. It's, yeah, it's in writing, but most people haven't read it. So I'm not even entirely sure that I buy this whole idea that Judaism is all about texts. So I don't know, that's where I'm sitting with as a starting point, Lex. What about you?
What I took away from a lot of our conversations is even people who are really into Bible from various angles often agree with that. Or I mean, well, there's different ways that I think that comes up. First off, there's the ways in which the Bible itself is not just book, right? I mean, what say Tzemach Yoreh shows us and others is that, like, this is a book that's like an end point from a bunch of things that were floating around as stories, as ideas before the book. So there's a way in which the book is just a recording down of things that were experiences and stories and very much sort of alive. And we're so used to a dichotomy of like written stuff and active experienced stuff. And a lot of our world is dualized, is split into two based on like what is recorded and what is experienced, what is written, what is done. And the Bible, as so many of our guests talked about, and I'm thinking of like Ron Hendel too, like it's alive in that fun monster voice. Like it's what I think people are drawn to and why some of our episodes were really popular isn't just the sense of like, oh, this thing is ancient. And so if we're trying to be part of this group of people that has a long tradition, you want to like be able to tie back to the first thing. I do think that's there for some people, but there's also a way in which like more and more people intuit that we get to be players, to use B'nai Lapi's language. We get to be shapers of what this text even is. We get to read the stories, take in the rules, and sort of apply our own lenses to it. And the Bible is a good text for that. For all the criticisms I have of the content of the Bible, all the rules I would change and do change, all the stories I think have the wrong morals, all that, like there's lots of those things. I do think the Bible has some really strong structural pieces, which is basically that it's kind of vague. Like it doesn't give you all the details. It tells stories in a very terse manner where you're able and almost required to fill in the gaps. Like we could argue that, oh, the rabbis are so creative and these people who came around with Midrash, with like later fan fiction, they're like so cool that they thought to fill in the gaps in the Bible. But like, honestly, I do think a lot of those things are cool. But like, you have to, in order for these stories to even make a basic amount of sense, you have to be building in your own ideas to connect A to B and B to C. It doesn't work otherwise. And you could see that as like a weakness, right? You could say, ah, oh, these ancient writers, they just like, they weren't as sophisticated as us. And so they didn't put in all the details. They had all sorts of blind spots and left things out. Like, maybe. But like whatever their intention, maybe they were sophisticated, maybe they were not, they gave us something that requires our input. And that's exciting and empowering when you're in a room of people, because like anybody who's been to a Torah study, and by the way, this is not just, you know, progressive new kinds of Torah studies, even Orthodox or traditional Torah studies. If you're looking at this text, like the very simple meaning of it is debated. It has to be.
What you're talking about reminds me of one of my favorite books, which is a book called Understanding Comics by the comics writer Scott McCloud. It's, how to describe this exactly, it's not a graphic novel because it's nonfiction, but it's what you would imagine to be a graphic novel, like a book-length comic book. But it's about the process of how comics are made. And there was an insight in that book that has stuck with me. It's this idea that in drawing comics, the simpler, the more sketchy the comic, the more relatable it is. And so the ideal form of that is the smiley face. It's two eyes and a mouth. Everyone can relate to that. Everybody looks at that and says, oh, that's me. you don't look at that and say, oh, that's somebody else. And Scott McCloud has a whole like psychological explanation of this, that when we communicate outside of ourselves, we communicate to another person. We only experience ourselves basically as two eyes and a mouth because we're just seeing and talking basically. But the bottom line is, he says, when you're drawing comics, the like less artful, so to speak, it is, the less beautiful, the less, you know, detailed it is, the more people are going to be able to relate to this. And then in the book, Understanding Comics, he goes on from there and he says, and that's true of language as well. So the sketchier the language is, in a way, ironically, the more one can relate to it and therefore the more significant it is in one's life. And I immediately jumped to the Bible from that. And now I would say also probably the Talmud, you know, this understanding that a lot of the stories are very, we don't know that much about Abraham and Isaac and Moses. I mean, we know a few details of their life. Everyone who really has read the Bible could kind of mention the same few details. That's because there's nothing else there. And that's maybe by design, because that's what makes the Bible more relatable. I'm also thinking about another question, which is like, why does a person write a text? I think that writing a text is a pretty conservative action. Like, what leads you to write something down? I think it often is like you're afraid that people are going to do it wrong in the future. So you want to, it's like a dead hand. You want to try to force the future to do it the way that you think is right. That's one reason. Like, another reason why you write things down is like everybody's, you write down the things that are different from what people are doing. Like, if everybody's doing things a certain way, you don't really have to write that down because I think in your mind, you kind of expect, oh, well, they'll keep doing it that way. You want to write things down when you're kind of disagreeing with the majority type of behavior. So if we start to play out some of those things, then potentially we have a way of looking at the Bible and other Jewish texts as almost by definition, the voice of a fearful minority, you know, the voice of the elite people who were looking at what the regular Jews were doing and were unhappy about it or fearful that they might stop doing it in the future and trying to freeze history by writing it down. And I wonder what the world would look like if instead of seeing those texts with reverence, we looked at them with skepticism, specifically because we thought about the agenda of the person who might have been trying to write them down.
I'm hearing you deeply, and I'm torn. The question you're asking, or maybe I'm making it a question, you said it sort of as a statement, like the question around whether writing down a text that is, especially one that's meant to be like a sacred text, is that an inherently conservative act, or how could it possibly be like a revolutionary act? I do see it as neutral. Like I see writing as potentially either of those. I think you're right that a lot of the biblical texts that we have were written from that place of fear. They were like, oh, if we don't get this noted down, then people are going to forget it and they're going to do it wrong. I absolutely think that's right, because they're scared that if they don't say it, then it'll be lost. I do think that even that in the Bible and otherwise, we have a lot of, I don't know, speculative fiction. We're about to be talking about that phrase, speculative fiction, a lot as a spoiler in some future episodes. I think we have some authors whose project is, what should the world be? It certainly isn't that. What, like, how do we create a vision of that in one way or another? And I mean, you've talked about that with respect even to the Exodus narrative, how, like, you know, if we take as a given, which not everybody does, but if we take as a given that, like, we being the Israelites or whatever, weren't actually slaves in Egypt, the project of centering a group of people who were slaves in Egypt makes a set of claims about slavery, about freedom, about, like, we could debate what those claims are, but like it is a big picture kind of project that I do think is not just coming from a fear place. I think it's potentially coming from a place of like, what kind of world do we want? How do we get there? That's, you know, the project you and I are trying to take on. I see that also in some of the other books, especially, you know, in the writing section, the parts that aren't meant as much to like note down history. I think of books like Ecclesiastes, Ecclesiastes people read as like nihilistic and almost non, it's just like nothing matters, but it, I don't think it's quite that. I think it's very much a kind of vision of the world that is important. I'm not being so coherent, but I think.
I think you are. I think what you're saying is right.
Cool. I think the writing question is big. And I mean, I've spent a lot of time reflecting on it with respect to the Talmud. I like the mapping you did between Torah and Talmud, because like in my Eli talk, even I was like, it was a controversial action to make the oral law, oral, to make the oral tradition not oral, to make it written. That was heretical. People hated that because it was deeply important to not write down as sort of a frozen text, because that's something that happens in text. That's the conservative piece. Like, if something is written down, it is in stone or on paper. Like, sure, you can take out a red pen and edit, but like, it is there in a way that words sort of float off. They're not substantial in the traditional sense we think of substance. And so words, you know, one person can tell a story and the next person will tell that same story and it's different. You know, you can think of it as a game of telephone where we're sort of shifting the story, shifting the goalposts. But what that allows for is, it's always going to be a little different based on the context, based on the storyteller, based on the time. And so there's a set of dangers with writing down texts. I do think that the balancing act that was achieved between writing down texts but keeping it vague in the way I spoke about before is a special combo. It's conducive to thousands of years of playing, which has been happening.
Yeah, I would just say, like, just to be clearer about the position that I'm developing, I think, is where the things that I said before, I actually believe both. You know, mm-hmm. I believe that we should look at every text with some degree of skepticism, because every text might have been written with an agenda of suppressing the alternative voice. And at the same time, every text might actually be one of the ones that snuck in that is the minority voice, or that was the preservation of multivocality. For example, I don't think we really talked about this with Temach, but when you look at like the story of Noah's flood, that's the famous story that's obviously written from two different authors. And you can actually quite easily tease them apart. It was the first story, I think, that biblical scholars really used to establish this idea that the Torah, the five books of Moses, were written by multiple authors, because you can so easily see that some texts use one name of God, some texts use the other, and there's, you know, 7 by 7 animals going on versus 2 by 2. And they woven together in a brilliant editorial way where actually for hundreds and thousands of years, people didn't really notice. But once you notice, you kind of can't unsee it. You could easily wonder and say, well, maybe that was like an editor saying, I think the people in my time aren't going to notice this, but I know people are going to come along one day and notice it. And hopefully that will happen at a time when they really need to notice it and it'll help them. And that's actually intentional. So I don't know. And I don't think we can know. And so I think the best way, though, is to approach it from a perspective of all of these things are possible. And that allows us to have a much richer relationship with the Bible than we have ever had before as Jews. Arguably, the ancient rabbis understood all this stuff and they did have that kind of relationship, but they were a very, very tiny elite. And so for me, and this is consistent with what Judaism Unbound has always been about, is that your average person today, your average Jew, your average non-Jew, whoever, has the education and the access to information that enables them to read the Bible or any text in a way that only the most sophisticated people in the world could have read it for most of human history. And the question is, what do you do when you live in a time like that? And by the way, this will be true, I think, I hope, you know, for time from forever from now on. I hope we don't have like a dark ages where we backslide. So how do we imagine a world in which you expect that every reader is a sophisticated reader? And the only thing holding someone back from being a sophisticated reader is that they've been told, they've been, I would argue, miseducated to believe that this text is one that we look at reverentially and we don't read that way to this text. Mm. I mean, you want to read James Joyce that way? Oh, fine. But don't read the Bible that way. And it's like, that to me is insulting to our intelligence. And so the question is, instead of being afraid of a time when people could read that closely, as I think many commentators like Ibn Ezra and Maimonides, who I think did see all of this, and they were, I think, kind of afraid of the possibility that would get out to the common people. And they kind of intentionally didn't want it to. What would a world look like in which the common people, so to speak, actually all see it? And I don't think it's a scary world. I think it's an exciting world.
people more and more, I think, are realizing we're characters in the Bible. I'm thinking of Liana Wortman's citation of a beautiful chavruta model, like study partner model, where there's a triangle. And the three points on the triangle are the text, partner one, and partner two, with the two partners being the ones who are like engaging with the text. Like, that doesn't quite say that you're in the text itself, but I feel like that's a necessary conclusion, and it's a liberating conclusion. Like, oh, when I engage with this text and when somebody else engages with this text, it's a different text in many ways. And this isn't something new. There's lots of literary theorists. Maybe we should have some great literary theorists on and talk about reading, like what reading is and how we read. But there's something exciting when I am in the text to the point that, like, I have agency over what it even is. When you don't think that the text was given with hard and fast rules thousands of years ago, and our job is, like, to keep to those rules and maintain those rules and pass it down. Like, once you come to the conclusion that, like, oh, the point of this is to unlock something in each of us, which may or may not have been its original intent. I'm with you. I don't know what the original intent of the different authors were. I think they probably had different intents. But my intent as a reader is I would like to be changed. I would like parts of me to be unlocked and pushed and supported. So often we think it's bad if we like find and cherry pick texts that support us in what we think. I don't think that's bad. I think that's good to be able to find words in texts that help us clarify what we think. Like, we are characters. We are in it and not just sort of observers of a static, eternal document. And like, that's, I don't think I'm saying something that creative. Like, we know this with other texts. We understand the idea of breaking the fourth wall in theater, where the people on the stage, you know, come out into the audience. You know, that's a move that people make, but I think it's almost an implication of a text that's being used for sacred purposes. Like, this text doesn't exist as, it's like, it's not like a one-point, one-dimensional thing on a graph that we're looking at. It is multidimensional, such that we are in it and part of it and changing it and shaping it and using it. And whatever this text was meant to be originally, it was meant to be engaged with, which means the people in doing the engaging are characters. And so all of a sudden, that's a responsibility too. It's like, I have to be mindful of my role in the story. I don't want to be the enemy in the story. I don't want to be the one that's using this for terrible ways, but it's, I don't know, it's liberating for me.
I thought maybe we could talk a little bit in the context of what you're saying about Midrash, about, you describe it often as like fan fiction. But, you know, the basic idea, you think about it in the world of Harry Potter or something, is that there's a whole world that's created by a particular author. But in that world, you can start to say, I can envision other stories happening in that world with these characters, maybe with other characters. But it's sort of other authors adding their visions into this world that may have initially been constructed by one author, or in this case, by one school of authors. And Midrash is this ancient Jewish version of that, where all kinds of stories have been added to the canonical, written down in the Bible stories. So much so that some of these Midrashes, first of all, some of them are actually written in a different book, like in different books, the Talmud and others. Some of them become so ingrained in people's thinking that they don't even realize it's a midrash, and certainly kids don't. So I remember a case where my son came home from school, and I don't remember exactly what it was. I think it was something about Abraham breaking his father's idols. Maybe that's what it was. I don't remember. And I said to him, well, you know, that's not actually in the Torah. And he says, it's not. My teacher said that it was part of the story. You know, he was.
And it is. It's part of the story, is what I mean. Yeah,
but I mean, like, and maybe the teacher at the end of the day was right in teaching it that way because he had this more expansive idea of what Torah is, you know, but definitely my son kind of had the impression that it was written in the book and was surprised to hear that it wasn't. And I think that one of my questions that I wanted to think about a little bit is, what is the impulse to write Midrash? Is that an impulse that comes from being afraid of a certain point of view that's dominant? You know, in other words, it may be bad, it may be good, but it's about that fear-based. Or is it coming from a place from this imaginative, creative, hopeful, where I want to add this. And I'll give you an example. For me, one of the most interesting parts of the Bible is how little we are told about the Northern Kingdom of Israel. And the Northern Kingdom of Israel was around for about 200 years or so, let's say 200-300 years. That's around the same amount of time that America, United States has been around. That's a long time. So imagine we knew that there was this country on earth, the United States of America, and it was around for 300 years, and now it's not around anymore. But that's pretty much all we know. And those of us who have grown up here for our whole lifetime are like, that would be all you, like, so much, there's so much, there's so, right, there's so much that's happened. So that's kind of the situation. And that was the motivation for me to really work to get Yochi Brandes's novel translated. And we've talked about that, but I think it was the motivation for her to write it. And I still feel like there's so little Midrash being written today that's kind of that magnitude. There's little Midrash, but there's not so much big Midrash. And I wonder if part of that is because, like, there's something about once we're enlightened, sophisticated people, there's like, but we know that story is not true. And so why should I write another not true story?
I think there's a classic thing that Jewish educators do, rabbis do, et cetera. And it involves what you talked about with your son. Like, there's the story of Abraham. And people say this story. They're like, why is he chosen? Well, he destroyed his father's idols, et cetera, et cetera. And I, of course, that's not in the text. And I think that's often the end of the conversation in the religious school classroom. And I want that to be the beginning of the conversation, because there's multiple conclusions you could take from that's not in the text. One is, we were told a false story. The story is what's in the book of Genesis. And we need to enshrine as a secondary status the stuff that is told later, the midrashes, mm-hmm. etc. That's one takeaway. I think that's most people's takeaway, given how we've been educated. But if we don't think that the Torah, like you said, if we don't think the Bible is factual, that kind of true, then what does it even mean for something to be a secondary status to that? It doesn't matter. And so my philosophy is that is in the story. Now, I do think it's important just from a historical standpoint for people to understand, like, certain layers of this text were written at different points, were told at different points, and layers of meaning were added, and that means we can do it. Like, I want to teach people that Midrash is a thing, because then we can do that thing. Mm-hmm. But I've actually sort of stopped using the phrase modern Midrash, or like I've stopped talking about what we do today, you and me and others, with the gap filling, with the fan fiction. I've stopped talking about it as Midrash, and I've started talking about it more as Torah. And I think I might have mentioned this before. Like, we have to stop with us being underlings, you know, below the authors of the text. We are equals. We're not above them. We don't get to say automatically that their voices are gone. That would be erasure. That would be no good. But we do get to say we're equal. And so we should be creating modern Torah, not modern Midrash. I think modern Midrash is a safe term. It's like, we can write beautiful works of fiction. We can have the Red Tent. We can have, books like Anna Solomon has written. We can have all this. And it's like beautiful enrichment of the Torah. I think it is entirely good for people to think that, like, the story, in quotes, of Dina, for example, the character in the book of Genesis, is basically the Red Tent. Does the Red Tent have things that aren't in the original story as it was written? Yes. But by the way, was that original story in line with what all the previous people were telling around fires? No, I think the original story left out stuff too that we will never know. There is no one version. So, like, we're Torah makers. We're not Midrashers. That would be to say that we get to sort of sprinkle toppings on the ice cream. We are the ice cream. I don't know. I'll find a different metaphor. But, like, that's so important to me. And this links, by the way, to a phrase that bothers the heck out of me, which is the Midrash. Mm-hmm. People talk about the Midrash. I've heard people criticize that phrase in the past, including professors of mine. I'll quote Michael Sattlow, who's a wonderful author about lots of related topics. He had a very memorable rant in my class where he was like, never use the phrase the Midrash. It's inaccurate. Like, there's not like one book called the Midrash. And people think there is. People think there's like a book similar to the Talmud, which also is two different Talmuds, but that, like, the people think there's one book that's like the Midrash, and that's the set of fan fictions that count, in quotes. That's sort of where he left it, right? His problem was that it's inaccurate from a scholarly standpoint, to use that phrasing. My problem is that, and it implies that the Midrash is done. It exists. And what we're doing is, I mean, it would be like an underling to the underling. It's like, oh, our modern Midrash is like the third level, the tertiary, beneath the secondary, which is the Midrash, and then the primary is the Torah. Like, we are primary. We are in it. We are doing this thing. And so not only are we on the sidelines of the source sheet, in the borders, on the margins, we should be the center. And we shouldn't feel bad if we tell a story that has a detail that's not in the original text. I recently was talking to people about Prince of Egypt, the movie, which I have talked about in the past as Midrash, but I want to argue in this vein is Torah. Like, Prince of Egypt makes a claim, which is that Moses grows up unaware that he was born an Israelite. The text is unclear on that. It is not at all clear whether Moses knew he was Israelite or not. You could read it either way. We don't have any of his childhood, basically. We have his babyhood, and then we have him killing an Egyptian slave master, and very little in between. Could you say that it made a claim that was inaccurate? It took this text in a way that is unfair because it made an entire movie out of the idea that he had no idea he was an Israelite. You could say that. But that would only be true from the standpoint of modern films can't themselves be the text. And I think that they can and should be. And we should, not only should we feel allowed to do that, it's the necessary work of our time to be doing that.
Right. And this really makes me think of a kind of theory that B'nai Lappi and I have been trying to work out on our other show that we do called The Oral Talmud, where I kind of want to think about the story of the giving of the Torah, the events of Mount Sinai, because what seems to have really happened in the story, in the original version of the story, like maybe a Tzemach Yoreh kind of version of the story, is that the Ten Commandments were given at Mount Sinai, and that's it. And in future iterations, there's always more that was given at Mount Sinai. So initially, it's the Torah, like the sort of dictated book of the Torah, and Moses eventually writes it in a scroll. And then many, many hundreds of years later, when the rabbis are reimagining Judaism after the destruction of the Second Temple, they come up with this version of the story where it's not only the Ten Commandments and the written Torah that were given at Mount Sinai, it's also the oral Torah, the oral tradition. And that eventually gets written down partly as the Talmud. And it's not even fully written down as the Talmud, so there's still kind of oral tradition left over. And there's other books, pseudo-books, not books, like the Tosefta and other things like that, that are part of that oral tradition. Now, B'nai and I have been talking about this idea that maybe that whole idea that there was a written Torah and an oral Torah given at Sinai is an inaccurate statement of what's really true to the extent that anything is true. What is really true is that it was only the oral Torah that was given at Sinai, and that oral tradition was written down, or pieces of it, I should say, were written down for different reasons at different points in time. And the difference is that if that's the way that we see it, then the only advantage or claim to some kind of higher status that any given piece of writing might have is that it was one of the earlier ones that was written down. But that doesn't mean that it's the more important one necessarily that was written down, right? We shouldn't be more reverent towards the first thing that happened to get written down than we should be towards the Red Tent or the Prince of Egypt or the Book of V. Now, where I'm trying to take this one step more, I'll sort of float this idea and see, and I'm not 100% sure that it advances the ball, but I think it does, is to say, well, what if there was actually a third Torah given at Sinai? It's the written Torah, the oral Torah, and B'nai talks about Svara, the Torah of our intuition, the Torah of our own. In other words, that Torah is built into our bodies. We are that Torah. So everything that a person produces out of their own sense of moral intuition is itself Torah. And one way to tell the story is that there were three Torahs given at Sinai, the written Torah, the oral Torah, and the Torah of Svara. But using my paradigm, we would say, actually, the only Torah given at Sinai was the Torah of Svara. And that got translated into, you know, has been translated into this oral Torah, which is a more formal working of this material. And that itself has gotten written down over time. But at the end of the day, it's really just Svara. And I don't know, like, I think when I look at somebody like Jeffrey Katzenberg, you know, making The Prince of Egypt, or Anita Diamond writing The Red Tent, or Anna Solomon writing The Book of V, I look at those people and I say, these are what in another age might be called rabbis, right? These are people who have great wisdom and great knowledge. And I trust their Svara, right? I trust that what's written sort of in their heart and their soul to be true with a capital T. And so you can kind of see this unfolding Jewish tradition that emerges out of that, that is so much vaster than how it's often taught to us as like commentaries on a text. No, it's the opposite. It's the text comes out of the commentary, so to speak, that the commentary precedes the text, something like that, that I think is a very exciting way to think about Torah and the unfolding of Torah.
Yeah, I'm just trying to find more precedents for what we're arguing, because I could anticipate people saying like, well, Dan, Lex, look, like, I hear what you're saying, but ultimately, if everybody accepted what you're saying, then we'd basically just have anarchy. By the way, I'm not convinced that's so bad, but like we basically have no common ground and everybody sort of comes up with their individual version of what the story is. I want to sort of not dismiss that and think about it. And I'm thinking, like we did with Abraham Reisman, about the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And in the last year, largely due to necessity, they've made a really important move, which also is it's a modality move. It's a media move, just like written to oral. It's not quite as big, but it used to be that the Marvel Cinematic Universe was a set of movies. It was a set of a bunch of movies that spoke to each other in groundbreaking ways, that had characters that in one movie might be sort of a bad guy and another might be good. Like it pushed a lot of boundaries, but it was all movies. We now have Disney Plus, and there's now TV shows that are equally part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, despite being a totally different modality. And that feels similar to me to saying like, ah, it's not just the written text of the Pentateuch anymore. It's our oral stuff. Like, and to me, that feels like only the beginning. Like once you've broken that it has to be movies, who's to say it has to be visual? Like, why can't, so like we could have books. I mean, it'd be funny to sort of, it's not that it's backwards, but to go from film into books and those also be in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Like, although I guess it started with comics, so it's circular, whatever it is. I'm excited by that. And I think that the storytelling maneuvering that we can do in different modes it only strengthens the whole project. So I don't think what we're calling for is like, let's tear down the written modality. It's let's embrace every different form of storytelling we can have, every different experience that can contribute to this, and have a more full, more beautiful canon, for lack of a better term. I'm not totally sold on whether it even is a canon or what we're desiring as canons, but at the very least, a proto-canon, a new set of shared stuff. And the version of that proto-canon, that set of stuff that's going to be most compelling, I think, just as, you know, these Marvel folks determined, is going to be one that straddles different modes, that includes that original written stuff, the oral stuff, and then also, as you just beautifully described, the experiential Torah, the Svara, the Torah of our intuitions. And in order to contribute that Torah, we have to all sort of grant ourselves collective permission. And that's a big step. We have to, once again, sort of, I said this before, but we have to say this over and over. We have to be agents. We have to be players on the field of Torah making, not just, you know, midrash making or interpretation making. We have to be the ones ourselves that can do this. And look, people may feel that that's some level of anarchy, but my question is, what are the dangers of the converse, of having so many limits, so many bounds that we actually can't move forward at all? Do those limitations, do those negative factors of what happens when we are so afraid of anarchy outweigh the negative factors when we embrace something that could veer in that direction?
Yeah, I mean, this question about anarchy is an important one. I mean, look, there's some people, and sometimes when you say, oh, anarchy is fine, you know, I'm not necessarily here to bash anarchy. In our time, when there's not authority to police the interpretation of the text. And there's also not authority to police the acceptance of the text. So instead, what you just have is people offer their ideas, interpretations, or sort of new texts. And whether it becomes part of the canon is based on whether the people come to accept it. It makes me think of a story that I've probably told before on the podcast, where I was running an organization and we would study Jewish texts with our staff. And I once was reading the story of Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, and he comes and he gives Moses this advice about how to manage the people. But before that, he basically talks to Moses, and Moses tells him it's like really been hard since we left Egypt. And Jethro's like, wait a second, you were released from slavery and now you're free? Like, what an amazing story. What an amazing God. And he throws a big party for all the elders. And I said that my take on that is that Jethro is giving Moses leadership advice there as well. And he's saying to Moses, you know, you're a real downer of a leader, and you can't be a good leader when you're an emotional downer. You have to get the people's emotions up. And so one of my staff members says to me, wow, that's, you know, really an interesting interpretation. Like, what commentator did you get that from? You know, and I said, oh, no, I just read it. And that's what I thought. And she said, you can do that? And my response was kind of like, well, I mean, I don't know. I just did. You know, like, who's out there to stop me? You know, like, I just did. Like, that's how it works. And so there's a way to be reverent toward a text and to say, you know, we really care about this text. It's important. I don't want to dismiss those earlier manifestations of our svara, you know, our moral intuition or the oral tradition that got into writing earlier. We should have some degree of reverence towards them because they've been around a long time and they're part of our story. They've been part of our story as written text for a long time. But having reverence for them on that level doesn't have to mean that we can't also have reverence for those new texts and those new interpretations, or even more than interpretations, like new writings that essentially flow out of the same source that original text flowed from, which was, you could call it God, you could call it our svara, but it comes from the same source and therefore is not to be revered any less.
It's a weird connection, and I'm hesitant. Like, if folks have pushback on this from whatever angles, please send it, because I'm not like fully convinced of this. But I'm thinking, you use the word like we have to stop policing. And I'm thinking about contemporary discussions about policing. And a lot of us are part of movements that call for defunding the police. And there's the whole discourse about that, right? And there's people who say, like, what do you mean defund the police? Like, we have to have people in society that are, who are in roles who are officially meant to provide for our safety. Now, first off, are police actually doing that is the question. I don't think they are for huge constituencies in our society. I would argue similarly. Like, I don't actually think that the contemporary place of Judaism is that our sacred texts, which we are policing the meaning of, are like actually protecting all of us. I don't think that. I think they are protecting some over others, consciously sometimes and unconsciously other times, and we should question that. Now, I also think that in the defund the police conversations, defunding the police isn't just about not funding police. I mean, that's part of it, but it's also about you take that money and you channel it into resources, into support systems for local communities. And that's so important. And that's positive, proactive work. That's not just like anti-work. And that's what I believe we are saying about how we use Torah. Like, it's not that we want people to just say, oh, everything we got was bad. We like, oh, it's gone. We want to channel the resources that have been put into policing interpretations. And is this the right thing? If you allow for this, is that a slippery slope? Are we then going to have anarchy? We want to put those resources into, like, let's have a million amazing Torahs like the Red Tent and like the Book of V and like the experiences of human beings today. Like, let's actually realize that we have a responsibility to do that work. And it's not that everything's a zero-sum game, but like, if you're spending all your time being cautious about, you know, which interpretations are good enough and which aren't, like, it's just a reality that our collective Jewish body of people is not going to spend as much time on that proactive work. So that feels important. I like the reverence word you use too. And like, one other thing that it made me think of is like a good test of reverence for something, a reverence for a Torah scroll, say, like, I believe even many of our listeners, even me, honestly, if I were to say to them, on Simchat Torah, when we take out the Torahs and parade around the room, you know, we unscroll the thing, what if we took out our markers and wrote our own takes in the margins? I think even many of our listeners who are ready to be radical, even me in certain ways, would be like, I don't know. Because there's that reverence, right? But if I were to push myself and say, like, what if I understood the absence of our markers in the margins as a huge problem? What if I understood the fact that we are not doing that, that we are not giving ourselves the permission to be on the page, on that actual scroll, not just providing takes on it, being commentators about it, but being in it? Like, what if that's one of the core problems we have, and it means that we are approaching Judaism in a set of ways that does not allow it to fully flourish? Like, I think part of me is like, yeah, we should take out our markers and do that. I want to push us on that, because even you and I don't know your instinct on the markers thing, but even you and I think, end of the day, as much as we talk this talk, kind of hold a reverence to certain kinds of sacred objects, sacred texts, where like we even would have a barrier in place there. That has to be on the table, to take proverbial and literal markers to our sacred
things. Well, I don't know if the margin is big enough. Like, I don't have a problem with what you're saying, but I'm not sure that the margin is quite big enough for that. So we'd have to figure
out, get some design thinkers in, and we'll have new versions of the scroll with more space.
But the bottom line is that I think that I'm totally with you on this idea that what's really important is for us to write our own Torah today. And that doesn't necessarily mean to write it down, but to for us to really understand what we're doing today as Torah. I mean, it's ending in a place that I didn't really expect in terms of this series on the Bible, where we were looking at how the Bible as we know it came to be. But I think that where we're ending up really is that the Torah is unfolding, and that we are fully authorized to call what we're doing Torah.
We're going to close on this note, and we really now more than ever welcome your thoughts on what came up today. And there's a bunch of ways that you can be in touch with us. There's our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. There are our other social media handles on Instagram and Twitter, all at Judaism Unbound. There's our website, judaismunbound.com. And you can always email us at dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. As a reminder, like Dan said at the top, we love, 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 and deeply appreciate when folks are able to support us either on a one-time basis or, and we're emphasizing this right now, the monthly recurring basis. And if you become a monthly recurring donor, you can submit a question that you have that you want to be vocalized on the podcast. We're excited about that. So thank you again so much for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.